Hello, mighty listeners.
Howdy.
Howdy indeed. Welcome to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward. Couple of bits of Podmin to get through. First of all, thank you to our Patreon supporter, Matt Tusenfot, who requested the topic of this week's show. Hello to Matt from England to you in Sweden. You might just be... No, you're not our first international Patreon, don't
No, I? We've had a couple, yeah.
We've had a couple, but I think you might be our first from a non-English-speaking country.
I mean, their English is better than our Swedish, let's be honest.
Oh, no, it absolutely is. I still am delighted by the novelty of the fact that we're listened to in countries which we have either never been to or visited fleetingly.
Yeah, that's true.
So thanks so much for that. We hope you enjoy it. If you would like to join Matt in both supporting this show and getting the opportunity to get involved in the production process, then you can go to patreon.com/worstfootforward. You can donate as little as $2 a month, which is basically just a cheeky little slap on the back to say well done and keep it going. $3 a month will get you a whole bunch of extra content. We do seasonal episodes, offcuts. I sometimes put some stand-up on there. If you pop in $5 a month, like Matt's, you can choose a topic. $10, you can judge a show. $20, you can come and appear on a show, which some people will be doing once they are either in this hemisphere, or we can organise an entire group of D&D players.
Yeah, it's true.
We've got a couple of great ones coming up with that some point this year. We're also changing our goals on Patreon. Some of them are staying the same. We still want to be able to have time to publish a book to put on live shows. But as offers to you, we haven't yet worked out the where we're going to put them yet. Basically, once we get a certain number of Patreon supporters, we are going to do certain special things.
Extra silly live or filmed or audio content that we wouldn't normally do.
Yeah.
So but for some reason have decided are a good idea to do.
Yeah, precisely. So the next one coming up is 50, where if we get 50 patrons, then we will throw a dinner party based on the Futurist's cookbook and invite four of you donors along to join us. We haven't worked out what the next levels will be, but some of the things we're thinking about are writing a 30-minute show where we act out the really infamous Orson Welles voiceover.
Yes.
We're going to get previous guest John Henry Fall to play Orson Welles.
He doesn't know it yet.
But he doesn't know this yet.
It's the role he's born to play.
Damn right it is. We will do a special quiz episode based on trivia that we found out on previous shows, where we'll have guests on and you guys can play along with it. We will put on an evening of poetry and play reading featuring Theophilus Marzials and Steve Bannon's Troilus and Cressida?
This story is aggressive, isn't it?
Yeah, his
Oh, is it Coriolanus?
No, it's Coriolanus.
Maybe a bit of McGonagall. Some of the bad sequel books we talked about as well, like Gone with the Wind sequel and things.
Yeah, and then the two other ones we're thinking about. One is putting on a screening, a double bill of Plan 9 from Outer Space, starring the very dead Bela Lugosi, and Listomania, starring Roger Daltrey, Ringo Starr, and way more plot than any two-hour film.
Oh god, so if you haven't listened to our episodes about the world's worst horror movie or the world's worst musical film, those are the winners of those two episodes.
And then the other thing we're thinking of doing is doing like a play-along show where we get some of our world's worst computer games and we sort of play along live with those. We've only done console games, we should really do like PC games to prepare ourselves for that.
Might be having a lead on that
Exciting. Get in touch. If there's anything along those lines that you think, those are great, we want to see those as Patreon goals, let us know. Equally, if there's things where you think, that is a terrible idea, warn us away from it.
Or if there are ones that we've left out and you suddenly think, oh, it'd be great to make them go to Japan and stay in that hotel with the robots in it. Feel free to donate the money.
Damn right. So that is how you can get involved in our plans for growing this podcast. As ever, you can get in touch with us at worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. I'm at Ben Mandeville. He's at Baz Maxday. We are at Worst Foot. And you are about to listen to this upcoming episode on the world's worst sportsmanship. Please enjoy responsibly.
Hello Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host, and our guest propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. And this week we are competing in the Worst Foot Games, an ancient athletic competition where there are wooden spoons for all who take part. In preparation, we've taken the appropriate measures to make ourselves faster, higher, stronger. For faster, I've attached an outboard motor to my back while my co-host has shoved a chili up his arse. For higher, I've opted for stilts while my co-host is baked off his tits to Sashange. And for stronger, I'm wearing particularly nasal assaulting cologne, and my co-host is injecting himself with DNA samples taken from the actor Mark Strong. Now all we can do is rake in the acclaim as we take garland after garland, and I think we have an appointment with WADA, the World Anti-Doping Association, afterwards. At least my friends have told me that they will be there to take the piss out of us. And alongside me is my co-host, the dope to my scandal, the Anna to my bollock steroid, and the dick to my pound. It's Ben Vandeveld.
I'm so happy that Dick Pound's name has come up this early in the podcast.
It is the best sporting administrator name ever.
Yeah, he's an IOC administrator, isn't he?
He founded WADA.
Oh, well, I don't think it's the first time he's appeared on this podcast either.
No.
because we were nothing if incredibly childish.
I want to have Dick Pound from WADA and Dick Wolf, who's the founder of the Law and Order series, to meet in a room. Just fight. Dick yeah. Wars.
Oh, come on, man.
That's something that you can commentate on.
Oh, please not.
Well, we all did sword fighting as kids.
Well, maybe in Irish schools, but not in mine.
Oh, you know, we had to amuse ourselves.
Did you? I mean, I've clearly misunderstood the rules of fencing. Because you're slightly more sporting than me. Did you?
It's a very slim scale. That's like saying I'm the best Guy Ritchie movie.
Hey, Snatch is excellent. Were you a fair player on the pitch?
Golf is my favourite sport, and golf is like maybe the most non-cheaty sport around. Like in some sports, you kind of laud people for bending the rules, and they, you know, you've got people like, say, Suarez jumps to mind as like a brilliant footballer, but he's got all these sort of rafts of allegations and bans and cheating. Whereas in golf, you're like, the rules are sacrosanct, and the idea, like, people will call penalties on themselves for accidentally moving a ball when nobody else would see it.
Right, let's introduce our guest this week. Our guest has just returned from Lima in Peru, where he was working at the Pan American Games. He's an extremely well-travelled gentleman and has worked across a range of sports for companies and networks all over the world as a commentator. He specialises in European and international football, and his voice has been heard commentating live and for various world feeds on highlight shows from beach soccer all the way up to FIFA World Cups, as well as in athletics, swimming, weightlifting, rowing, and handball. The pentathlon that we all really want to see.
Give it time.
Yeah. Whilst me and Barry are sat in our makeshift podcast studio, he's going to be coming to us live from a gantry suspended 100 foot above proceedings and giving us a full analysis of how the podcast is panning out. We are glad to welcome the professionally excitable and articulate Andy Bodfish.
Hello. Delighted to be here.
Yeah, lovely to have you here. Is handball the most esoteric sport you've commentated on?
Maybe.
Wait, did you say weightlifting in the midst of that as well?
Yeah.
How do you commentate on weightlifting?
Oh, weightlifting. It's let the pitchers breathe.
Yeah.
very much like tennis. You get in bits of information at key bits and then...
Yeah, you shut up.
There.
You know what I love? I love tennis commentary on the radio. I'm always so impressed by that because they obviously can't let the pictures speak for themselves.
Exactly. And it's a thankless task that it really is. Shot for shot. There needs to be something in between.
Yeah.
Tennis commentary on the telly and tennis commentary for radio, because going from "she looks good today" to not speaking again for 2 minutes, the way it plays out, to shot for shot in a tennis match, it's a bit of extremes there. So you doff your cap to the guys that do it on the radio.
And they must be in a case of the radio guys who are like, they get given maybe a match between Kevin Anderson and John Isner where there's going to be 120 aces. They do a lot more talking than the ones where it's like, you know, Gail Monfils.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah, it's a tough gig, that. It's actually a tough gig.
Yeah, it's not like, as in cricket, you can just like have a nice little narrative plays out amongst the day about what kicks have been brought in, and they talk about trivia from the 50s, but tennis is, you've got to be quick, quick, quick.
Cricket commentary is the biggest racket there ever was. Have you done any yet? I imagine that's like the cushy retirement job everyone wants.
Yeah, the thing is, me and cricket, we've never really got on.
Oh, no.
I don't like cricket. Cricket doesn't like me. And that's the way it's always been, the way it's always going to be.
What is your main sport? You football?
Football.
Yeah.
Yeah, no great surprise there. So brought up on football.
Who do you support?
Northampton Town.
Good.
Good. Yeah. I like it. It's like referees. Commentators and referees should support lower league teams. This they maintain it. Their neutrality. This,
yeah, I mean, again, it raises one or two eyebrows when you say that, but hometown club, you know, never been any other option, really. I have a soft spot for Liverpool because I went to university there, and I grew up when they were excellent, and, you know, that leaves its mark.
I grew up when they were really bad, which has meant that the recent upturn in success has been really quite a nice change, yes, change indeed, all round.
Indeed. Now, there's a lot to be said for the specific moment when, you know, someone gets that wider consciousness about sport, whoever was the big team at the time, happens to sort of make a mark on you and, you know...
Do you have a formative sporting moment which got you know hooked you into the love of sport?
It was a weird one really because I was lucky. The first football match my dad ever took me to, first match of season, what would it have been, 86-87, Northampton Town against Torquay United, and it coincidentally first ever football match. So that was the first match of Northampton Town's best ever season.
Ah.
Wow. So I was, 10 then at the time? So I went to, 2/3 of the home matches that season, 1 or 2 away games as well. Won the league with a record points tally, 23 points clear at Christmas. I'm thinking, this is the life.
It's always going to be this.
Exactly. And it's been slowly all downhill.
I feel like that having grown up supporting Newcastle in the 90s.
Indeed. Same. Yeah. We actually won something there.
Shots fired.
But I take your point.
Yes, the Intertoto Cup absolutely counts.
I'm guessing. How can one forget it?
Yeah, exactly. It's the most lyrically named.
No, honestly, fair play for having the least yellow cards the previous.
The Intertoto Cup was very much the participation trophy of European football for me, isn't it?
Let's crack open the champagne for the disciplinary chart.
Let's crack open that Aldi own brand champagne.
Yeah. Yeah.
So obviously you are excellent at commentating on sport. What are you least good in the world at?
Again, where does one start? So many things. I'm very, very scatty. I put things down and can't find them again.
Yeah.
Which... can be okay if it's trivial things, but when it's car keys and house keys and, so many stories.
What do you like in the commentary box if you've got, like, you know, stats written down or something?
I think it's a different zone there.
Okay.
Because I don't know. I'm not saying putting your car keys down on the same hook every time you come into your door doesn't matter. But I'll still work again, even if I lose my keys for a bit. So, you know, apart from the usual air conditioning starts and your papers get blown off the table and you drop your pen and you can't find it again... okay in that environment. It's just at home, I'm all over the shop, honestly. Yeah.
Are your, in the commentary box, are your notes immaculate? Because I've seen sort of like BBC commentators and it looks like the best GCSE revision. Like different coloured highlighters.
Quite geeky with that. Yeah, yeah, I'm probably part of that community.
I love it. It's great. It's a special pride in your work,
Yeah, I think it's that prerequisite. You need to have that geekiness and you need to like different colour pens and stuff.
Remember when Bob Monkhouse's joke books were stolen?
Yeah.
Imagine it'd be like John Motson's notes from whatever 40, 50 years of work. Just like that'd be like...
bulging folders.
Finding the original Bible written by God itself.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
Yeah, I love so. Well, that's the beautiful thing with sport. Particularly, I think, when you commentate on stuff other than football, there's a whole world of trivia out there, which is just completely delightful.
Yeah, and that's what I'd say things like the Olympics are. You've just been to the Euro Games, is that right?
European Games earlier this summer. Yeah.
All these, like, big events where there's lots of different sports. People are suddenly, like, experts in, you know, badminton, having never given a flying shuttlecock about it for their entire lives. Yeah. And they're like, oh, did you know this South Korean, he's been top ranked for like 17 years. You're like, oh, that's a fascinating fact.
You're just describing the career of a freelance commentator.
Yeah.
Badminton, I'm your man.
I looked up where the words sportsmanship and gamesmanship come
from.
I'm
glad someone else did this because this was my quandary as well. What is cheating and what is sportsmanship?
So cheating is a knowing breaking of the rules, whereas gamesmanship and sportsmanship is doing stuff outside of the rules of the game to try and wind up your opponent and draw them into performing below par.
Yeah.
So there is a book in 1947 called The Theory and Practice of Gamesmanship, or The Art of Winning Games Without Actually Cheating, by a chap called Stephen Potter. He cites the origins of gamesmanship being a tennis match in which he and a philosopher called C.E.M. Joad competed against two younger and fitter men who were outplaying them really easily. And whilst being outplayed, on returning a serve, Joad hit the ball straight into the back netting of the court, like 12 feet behind the back line. And while the opponents prepared for the next serve, he called out across the net in a very even and polite tone, "Kindly state clearly, please, whether the ball was in or out." And then the young guys were apparently so discombobulated by that, and he got in their heads that was then done for the rest of the match, because they were so confused by it.
By being so obviously out. It's like a player like using a challenge just to waste time nowadays and when
right,
the challenge
exactly.
is on the board.
Or snooker players standing in the way of a shot.
Laying their cue across the way.
Yeah, exactly. It's all that little niggly stuff, like... I can't remember whether it's Dennis Wise or Vinnie Jones. It's probably both of them.
Yeah.
But what they used to do if they fouled a player, but just a little innocuous foul, they would shake their hand and help them up. And as they helped them up, they would just nip the skin underneath the tricep or pull their armpit hair to get a reaction and then get the other player.
Yeah, no, you're thinking of Mark Shulver, who went to my primary school.
Yeah, it's a classic bully.
Yeah,
tactic.
I remember Vinnie Jones bog washing Phil Vaugh back in the day.
There is, though, this... I get it. I suppose it's being in that environment, you know, if you're part of a sports team, the alpha male community. Mm. I mean, a while back, I spent a little bit of time with one or two players in the England rugby team. You used to know Ben Cohen quite well.
Yeah.
You know, we had a few nights out, me and my friend, who his sister was married to Ben, so we were part of the group for a while. And we were in this pub in Paris, club in Paris, after one of the Six Nations matches. And we got into the VIP area and we just became the whipping boys. So, you know, me and my two mates, we would go to the bar, bring across a tray of beers, and all of a sudden people are tweaking your nipples and trying to trip you over. And it's like, we know you're harder than us.
Yeah.
Can I just bring the tray of beers over, please, and put them down? Do you know? You try to be all blokey and manly and take it, but if you're not part of that day in, day out, then it's just a bit annoying, to be honest with you.
It's the same way how in, like, Tom and Jerry cartoons, when a character is hungry, everyone else turns into a roast chicken.
Yeah.
If you're a rugby player, everyone else turns into a stress ball.
Yeah.
Just couldn't... Yeah, completely right. Couldn't stand still for 5 minutes. Nipples being tweaked, being picked up, headlock. Oh god, this isn't actually fun now.
Pass the parcel around. The
exactly
room.
Right.
When I went to university, I thought for a laugh, right, what sport can I do that I've never done before? And I ended up becoming a cox for the women's rowing team because in generally speaking, in rowing, men cox the women and women cox the men.
Yeah.
I became a plaything of the men's rowing team because I'm sure they could just pick me up and manhandle me all over the place.
Absolutely. Yeah, you'd be bubble wrapped and used as an oar.
Yeah. Tie a chain to you, use you as a human anchor.
Yeah. Bloody hell, that's bringing back awful memories.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting PTSD on this podcast. Let me tell you about some people who put it. I'm probably more cheating than gamesmanship, but I love the outrageousness of it. So, first of all, there's a British fisherman who won a trophy and $1,300.
How big was the trophy? Was it this big? Was it that big?
Yeah. Well, you sort of got to the nub of what he's done here.
Oh, no, really?
He landed the largest bass at a fishing tournament. However, before he could celebrate properly, he was arrested and disqualified because he got the winning fish from a local aquarium.
This is sensational.
Yeah.
Did he catch the scale of
the mendacity?
Yeah.
It's quite impressive.
Was it a Billy Bass and he just...
Yeah. I just love the thought of him coming out of the aquarium with kind of like a fish wrapped up in newspaper, I presume, under his arm. There's another great one. I'm going to come back to this for my suggestion of... trolling not an individual player, but an entire city or team. So the city of Stockton in California filed for bankruptcy. And soon after that happened, its minor league hockey team, the Stockton Thunder, was scheduled to play the Bakersfield Condors in Bakersfield. And when they turned up, the Condors welcomed its fans with a special promotion, "Our City Isn't Bankrupt Night." Which I think is really cruel.
That's out of like the Donald Trump playbook, that. I've got more money than anyone else.
Yeah. But if you want some real shithouse behaviour, you have to look at the Olympics. First piece of shithouse, 1932 Olympics. A Swedish equestrian called Bertil Sandström, who was a dressage performer. No, competitor.
Rider,
yeah. Yeah. And he was
It's the guy, not the horse, right?
Yeah, it's the guy who's misbehaving. He was demoted to last place for clicking to his horse to win.
Clicking to him to win?
Apparently that's not allowed.
So you can't go, come
nope.
on. Oh, wow.
Not allowed to. And he said that it was actually the creaking saddle making the sounds. I just like the bullshit of the claim. Oh, sorry, no, there's one before that. 1908 Olympics in London. So there's a chap called John Carpenter who won it, and he was disqualified for blocking the British athlete Wyndham Holswell, great old British name, and it was legal under American rules, but not under British rules. And as a result of the disqualification, the race was run again, and the British guy was ordered to face two other finalists who were both American, and they decided not to compete. And so it's the only walkover victory in Olympic history.
Wow, what distance is that?
That's 400 metres.
Wow.
So I just love the fact that a bit of bad sportsmanship has basically meant the British guy could just take a stroll around.
Saunter to the gold. Nice.
In 1936, obviously the Berlin Olympics, the record books show that a French cyclist won the 100-kilometre road race, coming up from behind to beat his teammate, Guy Lapébé, by 0.2 of a second. And Lapébé couldn't understand how he passed him. And what happened much later was discovered in Leni Riefenstahl's Nazi propaganda film, yeah. Olympia, because the final seconds of the race are shown. And as Charpentier gets close to Lapébé, he reaches out, he tugs on his shorts and uses it to propel past him.
Yeah.
Like, how gutted must you feel, like, finding out in a Nazi propaganda film that's why you lost?
That wasn't the only hand trick they played at those games.
Go on.
They entered a man in the women's high jump.
That's a bit cheeky.
Yeah.
This rings a bell.
Yeah. And it's not like a gender question thing. He said afterwards when he was at school, he'd properly taped his bits underneath himself, like drag queen style. I can't remember his name, but he basically said, the Nazis were kind of not sure that their female high jumpers would perform to the level they wanted. They didn't want to be embarrassed, so they thought to avoid embarrassment, they disguised me as a woman.
Wow, so he's like a 6'4" man called Klaus.
Yeah.
I think in terms of the worst behaved team ever, so in the 19th, I think it's the 66 World Cup, is Argentina versus Chile, which is the one that Coleman introduces as something like the worst and most disgusting behaviour.
That's the 1962 Battle of Santiago.
That's the one.
Chile against Italy.
Is that the one with the English referee who then introduced the cards?
Arthur Ellis,
yeah.
I think. Yeah, that's right. And that fantastic bit of footage, I know the bit you're referring to. What you're about to see is the most disgusting example of, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, it's like Coleman, like an angry headmaster.
Yeah.
But
that was outrageous. They just kicked each other.
It's a fight. It's a full-blown fight.
Kicked each other.
Yeah.
There's something worse, though. The Uruguay's men's basketball team at the Helsinki Olympics. So they won bronze, but they made enemies of everyone.
Yeah.
In their semi-final against France, all but three players were fouled out by the end of the game. I have never seen a basketball match where there was less than five players on the court.
Yeah.
But they ended up with three, clearly playing very aggressive defence. The Uruguayans also twice attacked the referees because of disputes, including once kicking him in the groin. And then
we're still allowed to continue.
Yeah. And then they also injured three players on the Soviet team when they played them. This is peak communist era Soviet teams. You're doing well to kick the shit out of them.
Yeah.
And then the final was Uruguay versus Argentina, which included a game-stopping brawl and so many fouls that at the end of the match there were only seven players on court altogether.
Sensational.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Sensational. Well,
that's great. That'd be the good old days.
Yeah.
So we can go back to that after Brexit.
But I've got two more to tell you about before my favourite one. There was an Iranian judoka who was considered a hero in his own country after the 2004 Olympic Games because he was deliberately disqualified. This chap called Arash Mirismali, because he knew in his next round he was going to fight up against an Israeli fighter. And obviously Iran doesn't recognise Israel as a country. Yeah. And I'm guessing he didn't want to either face the ignominy of losing to him or just want to face up to him at all. But the way he got around that is the night before the bout, he binge ate to make sure that he wouldn't be in the right weight category. So he basically made himself too fat to fight.
Wow.
And he was brought home to a hero's welcome. And the then president of Iran, Mohammad Khatami, said that his decision not to fight would be recorded in the history of Iranian glories.
You know those TV programs like Is Operation Transformation and The Biggest Loser, where people have to lose weight? I would love to get a show where you get like elite athletes have to put on weight to get to a certain level.
Or how much would you need to handicap elite athletes to have a member of Joe Public be competitive with them?
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
So like,
how much would you have to handicap Novak Djokovic to have a man off the street to just
take both legs?
Yeah,
how many
toddlers have to cling to Usain Bolt's limbs so that you can race them out there?
Have you seen? There's two wonderful pieces of footage. One is from Serena Williams after some tedious men's rights activist was going like, oh, she's not that good. And so she serves against one guy and the guy runs scared. And then the next clip, it's two guys. And it gets to the stage where there's about 12 men on the other side of the court and they still can't return.
It was when that survey came out of like, oh, 12% of men think that they could take a point off Serena Williams.
Yeah. And then the other brilliant one, there's a tradition in Japan, and we might have talked about this before, of getting professional footballers where three professional footballers take on 100 school children. It is the funniest footage in the world.
Yeah. That's the sort of challenge we want to see. I'd watch it.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm telling.
You'd be commentating
on it.
Yeah, I'd love to.
That's the one you'd like to get good luck remembering 100 Japanese names. It's another version of the would you want to fight one horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses.
Well, I'd like to see, okay, what would you think would win the derby?
Yeah.
One horse-sized duck.
Or 100 Japanese schoolchildren in a horse costume.
Yeah. But talking to horses, my penultimate one, I'm going to tell you about Sylvester Carmouche.
Oh, yeah.
Who raced Louisiana's Delta Downs in January 1990. It was a very foggy day, and he was riding a 23-1 outsider. And he rode it home to victory just over a second slower than the course record.
And by 24 lengths.
Yeah, which is a hell of a distance.
It's a long distance to win. It was only a mile long race. It's a huge distance for
a mile. He's basically won that by 0.8 of a mile, hasn't he? But what he did is he dropped out of the 1 mile race as soon as he was out of view and then quickly sort of ran across to the other side of the track and then nipped in at the end.
Yeah, it was quite a foggy day apparently, so nobody could see him. Yeah.
But my suggestion for the world to a sportsmanship are the Miami Marlins baseball team. They had a rivalry with the Washington Nationals. When they played at the Nationals' home ground, they tried to put them off their batting practice by playing pop music and rock music.
And they were just into jazz in Washington.
Funny you should mention that, because when the Nationals came to Miami, they played smooth jazz to put them off.
Smooth jazz.
Bit of Kenny G.
That's so
And then interspersed it with fart noises.
This is too much.
So childish.
This is too much. It really is.
This has become a feud. They kept like one-upping each other as they did like home and away matches.
I'd love it. Like they went to the next place and it was like Stockhausen music. And then like
the Washington Nationals show up with a 76-piece orchestra.
Diego in 86. Plenty of non-footballing ones as well. I mean, 94, Kerrigan, Harding. How bad was that?
So bonkers.
How bad was that? Your teammates.
And how mad do you want to win something that you'll go actually like physically damage them?
But I always think about that conversation. to break a leg.
Yeah.
Oh, you do.
Yeah.
Oh, I was joking. You do actually want me to break a leg.
I mean, that's the Thomas Beckett thing, isn't it? Someone rid me of this petulant ice skater.
Just ridiculous scenes. Part of the same team, because it was during the prior to was it the national championships, wasn't it? Which offered up Olympic qualifying places. I mean, as we know, she made it in anyway, didn't we? Didn't she? But amazing to plot something that bad.
On such a huge stage.
On such a huge stage.
Like, how are you not going to get caught?
As well as, no one will notice.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, there's plenty out there. I always think 1980 Boston Marathon.
Yeah.
Rosa Ruiz, the Cuban-American runner, who basically just changed into kit halfway through, during the race, sort of, you know.
Hopped out of the crowd.
Kind of round the final bend.
Yeah.
Came in, won it, and didn't get away with it, obviously, but was still treated as the winner.
She
until
in a record time for the Boston Marathon, the third fastest marathon time by a woman ever.
Exactly right.
And she had no previous of doing.
Well, she qualified by competing in the New York Marathon, which was a few weeks prior. Mm-hmm. But even that, she had cheated her way in there. Again, just pretty much walked into the finish area.
She took the subway for a bit of it.
Took the subway. Yeah, kind of walked in even more mendaciously. I think there was a suggestion that she said she had brain cancer.
Yeah, she was late applying to get in.
She was late applying to get in.
Please let me in. Yeah, I'm dying.
and then didn't race, but sort of made herself known at the end to race officials and was given a... She was given a... It was marked against her name that she'd finished, which then enabled her to run, qualified her for the Boston Marathon.
But did the Boston Marathon administrators not go, hang on, this is the chick who says she's got brain cancer?
Well, they must have been like, oh, it's very long term.
Yeah.
See, the great thing about it was that her time in Boston was 25 minutes quicker than the time in New York, apparently. But also at the end, people were like, how are you not sweating? How are you not shaking? And she said, oh, I just got up with a lot of energy this morning.
Were you wearing jeans?
Yeah.
Do you
know her career after that as well?
She was
done for embezzlement in 1982 and then arrested for a cocaine deal in 1983. So it was sort of a career path.
What a character.
Yes. Yeah.
And then I love sort of, you know, one of the last entries on Wikipedia or something like, in 2001 she was working as a dental assistant.
Yes.
Randomly banal, denouement. Wonderfully glamorous career that involved coke busts and cheating and TV cameras.
Imagine her though, if she's like, she's giving you the pink juice you drink when you're in the dentist. She's going, by the way, do you know what I used to do? I used to pretend I was good at marathon running.
Unbelievable level of plotting and planning. You know.
She's up there with, you know, Fred Lorce. He's the guy who he won, in inverted commas, the 1904 Olympic marathon at St. Louis. And it turned out he'd gotten a car for 11 miles in the middle of it, driven by his manager. He was a bricklayer. He qualified for the marathon by running a 7 mile long race. And he got a place in it. And then his manager gave him a lift. Car broke down, so he had to run the last bit to the stadium.
Oh my god.
Crossed the line, and then got disqualified, obviously. And the guy who won was given the prize after, a guy called Thomas Hicks. He had taken two doses of strychnine and eggs, which apparently was a stimulant in small enough, you know, amounts, and then a glass of brandy.
Yeah, that's the sort of prep we want to see.
He retired from running the next day.
Did he? Good. Okay.
But Fred Lorce did continue training. He actually did win the Boston Marathon in 1905.
Okay.
So he dedicated himself a bit more.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes, he was committed. Yeah. More committed. There was another, again, I remember probably going back to, you know, one of those interminable Channel 4 Top 100 of everything programmes. Top 100 cheating, for example. There was definitely a story of, I think they were brothers in South Africa. There was a marathon in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Two identical twin brothers.
Of course.
And they just swapped it, did shifts. Ran the marathon, won it, and literally a case of popping behind a lamppost where one would be waiting and the other one would slot out. And the other
Such
one would
a Scooby-Doo approach to winning a marathon, isn't
it? Cartoonish.
Top Cat.
Yeah.
That's what the Brownleys should do.
What, it's a little bit of prosthetics?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're close. They look quite similar. And, you know, they're both getting towards the end of their careers, maybe. It's a bit, I don't know how long they've tried these careers, but they've been around a while. Just, you know, go easy on themselves. One of them does the swimming, the one does the cycle, one does the run.
I want to see them do the marathon.
There is a third Brownlee brother, the unknown.
Yeah, Zeppo.
Zeppo Brownlee. Do you imagine there's like a brownie who's probably like a really leading astrophysicist, yeah, and the other two are like...
And there was a lovely sketch that someone I know did for BBC Scotland of the third Murray brother.
Oh yeah, I've seen that. That's great.
Of Judy Murray being quite a good actor.
Yeah.
About just how he's, you know, he's the one that we're very disappointed in. We don't talk about, and just him just failing at tennis every time.
I don't know, I like the Williams family who go on tour watching Serena and Venus. They just get to, you know, travel around to all the tournaments. I think that's quite a nice life.
Yeah, living it up with them.
Yeah, yeah. Just get your kid training now. What sport would you, as a new dad, what sport would you indoctrinate your child into?
If I could, I'd absolutely live out my football dream vicariously with my son.
There's too many footballers on the team. Like, there's 11 on every team, and there's a huge squad, and there's loads, thousands of football. You want to go a niche sport.
Okay, well, I mean, I really want to see Van der Velde number 9 in the black and white in your castle. He's going to be the chosen one.
Is he, though?
No, he's...
Would you let him work for Mike Ashley?
Okay, fine, I'm going to train him up to be an assassin and take out... What other sport? Well, his mum wants him to be either a gymnast or a Formula One driver, and I'm going to... Yeah, they're very different ends of the spectrum. I mean, you know, Formula One for the money, but gymnastics for the fun.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Shorter career gymnastics.
That is true.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then you can just join Cirque du Soleil. I don't know. What would be the most fun sport?
I think if you could get him to be, like, international poker player, because you only have to win one of those tournaments and you're a millionaire.
Yeah, I do not want my son to have a good poker face.
Get him lying too early on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Yeah, and that's very dangerous. Yeah. Very, very dangerous.
I know what you mean. Yeah, that needs to be nipped in the bud. Yeah.
Just for them to practice your bluffing. Yeah.
Anyone. No.
Have you ever commentated on, like, an outrageous moment of being witnessed?
Not obviously.
Yeah.
No. There were some funny goings on in a reasonably high profile event I did last year, where you wondered what exactly was happening behind the scenes. There was a team who were not expected to not get the victory they needed in this final group match to get through.
So cagey about it. Yes.
they were trailing 1-0 with the clock ticking, and they won a penalty, which didn't look like a penalty. It wasn't a penalty at the end of the day, which is okay, but we didn't even get to see a replay of it. And we just got, this is a sophisticated sporting event and so on. So we just got a locked off close up camera on the player that was adjudged to have fouled this other player.
The Russian, yeah.
So this player scored. This player of indeterminate nationality scored, and the nation went on to win. And you know, what are you going to say? You're not going to kick up a fuss, but something about it left a bit of a...
It is funny. There are certain sports where you watch, and when some sports you watch, and you go, "Oh, what an amazing result!" When an upset does happen, and there's some sports when an upset happens, you go, "How did that happen?" Like Olympic boxing, when Ireland went to the 2016 Olympics, and none of our fighters got any medals, we're like, hang on a second, how has this happened?
Is it not at the Olympics, is it a bit like the Eurovision judging?
Yeah, where I think you
know, if there's an Albanian fighter and you discover that the judges are Kosovan, Serbian and Croatian, like that guy could like literally kill his opponent and he would still not get through.
Yeah, they've been threatened with not being Olympic sport anymore.
Well, boxing, because it's so corrupt.
Because of the AIBA. The amateur
boxing. I would love it if other sports saw like organised matchups in the way that boxing did. Instead of there being a fixture list, like Man United had to negotiate to like play Real Madrid. But actually, if the board didn't want that, and this like there was like we just want an easy training match, and they had to play like Yeovil Town.
That's been very. United just would have stopped playing when Ferguson retired. Again, we're the undisputed champions of English football. We're never playing again.
Well, that's a fun wiki hole to go down as the unofficial football world champions. So it basically goes on boxing rules. It gets reset at the World Cup.
Oh yes.
But then, so who's France is world champions at the minute? But the next time France lose, it goes on to them.
Oh yes.
And then the team that beats France next time they lose, it goes on to them. And I think I'm sure.
Winner stays on.
Pretty much.
Winner stays on.
And some nerd has worked out the standings. I think, bizarrely, if you go all the way back to the start of internationals, the reigning world champions or the world champions who won the most world championship matches are either England or Scotland. which is, you know, if it's Scotland, that is, you know, small sucker for the performance they put on recently against Kazakhstan.
Yeah, quite. Yeah.
Bless them. Yeah. Right, well,
doesn't make you feel any better, is it, England?
No, it really doesn't.
It really doesn't.
Well, two World Wars and 17 unofficial Wars. I've mentioned him earlier on. Let's talk about Donald Trump. I read some extracts from Rick Riley's book, Commander in Cheat, about Trump's golfing cheating habits. Apparently, caddies at the Winged Foot Golf Club in America call him Pele because he's so famous for kicking the ball out of bad lies. His gimme, he sometimes in golf, you give a gimme, it's sort of a foot away from the hole where you're not going to miss it, and people say pick it up. Trump regularly gives himself putts of about 10 feet, and even once apparently Riley witnessed him giving himself a chip in from off the green. He once threw, so he played golf with a sportscaster in America called Mike Tirico, who Tirico apparently on his par 5, he hit his second shot on a par 5. Like, shot of his lifetime. He'd never hit a better shot. He thought the ball was about 10 foot away from the hole. At the end of the round, the caddy, who'd been caddying for Trump, came up and said, "Do you know what happened on that par 5? He said, "What?" "Your ball was 10 foot away from the hole. Trump got up there and chucked it in the bunker."
Oh, he's so petty.
Yeah, right? He regularly drives his golf carts onto the greens at golf courses.
Yeah,
which is such a dick move. Even if you own the golf club, you know, there's people who are playing behind you. And he's claimed his handicap is 2.8. Pros like Ernie Els, Annika Sorenstam and Brad Faxon, who've all played golf, and said he's a 10 at best.
I mean, that's still not bad.
It's not bad, but you know,
took the words out of my mouth. Yeah. Annoyingly, that's
annoyingly
not
bad. He did post a score because you've got to sort of keep posting scores regularly, sort of to maintain your handicap. He posted one in 2017 while he was president of a 68, which is quite a good score.
Yeah,
in golf.
Yeah.
Below 70 is a very good score. And then deleted it a while later. So maybe that wasn't as official as it might, as it should have been. He's also famous for not paying contractors working on his golf club buildings. And he even tried to once not pay out the prize in a $1 million hole-in-one contest because he claimed that the yardage stated on the hole was wrong.
Oh, come on.
So, yeah, newsflash, guys. Donald Trump equals dick, turns out. I was at a famous sporting scandal. I was at the Bloodgate match between Leinster and Harlequins in European Cup 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So, people who might know this story, Harlequins played Leinster in the quarterfinals of the European Rugby Cup in 2009 in April at the Stoop in London, Harlequins' home ground. After 47 minutes, Nick Evans, the fly half, who's the regular goal kicker for Harlequins, went off with a thigh injury and was replaced by Chris Malone. 20 minutes later, 67 minutes in, Malone tore his hamstring and had to be replaced by a winger, Tom Williams, so they didn't have a proper kicker on the field anymore. Fullback Mike Brown took a penalty on the 72-minute mark. 80 minutes is a full rugby match, so 8 minutes to go. Missed the penalty, so Leinster were winning 6-5 with 6-7 minutes of the game left. Then Tom Williams apparently suffered an injury because blood was spewing from his mouth and he was taken off. Because in rugby, if you've been taken a player off, you can't bring that player back on unless it's for a blood replacement. So Tom Evans, despite being apparently injured, came back on to replace Williams. Nick Evans came back on to replace Tom Williams and had a go at a drop goal that would have won the game for Harlequins and put Leinster out. Missed it. Leinster went through and did go on to win the championship. After an investigation by the European Rugby Cup and the RFU, they discovered that Harlequins had faked injuries in this match and four others with blood capsules in the mouths of players so that they could either cycle players on and off to recharge the batteries or, in this case, to get a kicker back on the pitch when it was such a tight game that a kick of the ball might win it.
I love that it's the place where rugby union meets WWE wrestling.
Yeah. Oh, it was insane. And I remember when that substitution happened, being in the stadium, and Leinster were not happy with it. There was shouting going on. They felt that something was weird about the whole situation. And to try and cover it up, the team doctor for Harlequins, Dr. Wendy Chapman, actually took Williams into the dressing room and cut the inside of his lip with a razor.
Oh,
so
God.
To retrofit the idea that maybe he did have an injury in him.
And with something as planned as that, that's how insidious that sort of cheating.
Yeah.
Because the amount of people it drags in.
Yeah.
Oh, Williams was banned for 12 months. The director of rugby, Dean Richards, got 3 years of a ban. The physio was banned. There was a fine for the club of £250,000. The chairman resigned. Dr. Chapman was temporarily suspended by the General Medical Council.
Because it's all very well having a word with someone's ear. You know, should we just try this? But when it becomes almost like you would have to plan it and write notes and send text messages. Maybe everyone's in a WhatsApp group about
it. And you look back at it. It's like the Lance Armstrong stuff. How it was. It's not just as simple as
the industrial scale of it.
It's not just one person. And the thing, and obviously, I mean, it was such a tight game. Leinster did go on to win the championship. It could have all been very different. And now looking back at it, the blood that pours out of his mouth is so obviously fake.
Wasn't there an element of farce to it anyway? Because didn't he drop the capsule or something before putting it in his mouth and biting on it? Which I think was caught by a pit-side camera and so on. Again, he shined a light on it afterwards. How on earth did you think you were going to get away with this, guys?
Exactly. And I mean, the fact that they had done for four previous matches and then they just got caught in this one, it turned out. Another golf one, David Robertson was taking part in qualifying for the British Open in 1985, and his playing partner thought it was a bit odd that he would hit his balls and sort of walk quite fast up towards the green ahead of them. On the 14th hole, one of his playing partners called in an official and complained Robertson had been pretending his ball had been marked. So he'd get to the green ahead of them, lift his ball up without putting down a marker, pretending to clean it, and he'd have a ball marker, a little flat disc, on the back of his putter, and he just casually would walk around and slide it off the back of his putter quite near the hole. So when it came to replacing his ball, he put it down in the position that his playing partners assumed the ball had been in when he'd reached the green.
That sounds like a contraption invented by Q Branch.
Yeah, just pop it down. Yeah, apparently he'd shortened some putts by as much as 20 feet. He was banned and fined £20,000, which he never played.
So cheeky. Yeah, it really is.
I'm very disappointed when I don't hear about golfers cheating by waggling their trouser leg and a ball coming down.
Isn't
that what Goldfinger does?
Yeah,
in golfing.
Yeah,
that's exactly.
Completely in Goldfinger.
No, there's some really great examples of sportsmanship in golf. The Ryder Cup in 2006 in Ireland, Paul McGinley was playing J.J. Henry. At this point, the Europeans had beaten the Americans and they were finishing out the other matches. Europe would have set a record for a win over the Americans, but McGinley offered a half to Henry on the 18th green rather than making him putt quite a long putt that if he'd missed it, McGinley would win, because a streaker had run across the path of his putt. See, this 20-foot putt, and McGinley just gave it to him and said, no, that's not fair, you shouldn't have to putt that, and gave him a half, which is a very nice
gentleman move.
The slow player recently, I mean, this is, you know, pretty, oh, yes, you know, yeah. with a small S, sportsmanship. Yeah. Is it DeChambeau, Bryson DeChambeau?
Xander, yes, it is DeChambeau, yes.
Bryson. It's DeChambeau, isn't it, who takes half an hour, has a cup of tea, doesn't he?
Yeah. two minutes and ten seconds over a 10-foot putt in a tournament recently.
How long?
2 minutes, 10 seconds.
That's nuts.
Yeah, that's going to get into your head if you're playing behind it, if you're playing in that group.
Apparently Brooks Koepka, who's the world number one in golf at the moment, he says on occasions he's gone to the loo and just sat in the loo for 5 minutes, because then it puts his group on the clock because they thought that they're being too slow and out of place. So then it's the officials will come and watch the group and will see his playing partners being as slow as they are. So he has to engineer the fact of getting them on the clock in the first place. He just goes sit in the toilet and wait.
Exactly. But already he's changing his rhythm, he's changing the way he arranges his day. He's not thinking about his own game anymore, is he?
Yeah,
he's,
you know. It's not helpful. We haven't mentioned much about cycling. And I really like, obviously, drug cheating goes hand in hand with the Tour de France. but I really like the way one guy tried to get around his drugs test. In 1978, a cyclist called Michel Pelletier won the Alpe d'Huez section of the Tour de France, took the yellow jersey, and then was asked for a urine sample. While he was peeing into the jar, the person who was conducting the test was a bit suspicious about the way he was pumping his elbow, rather like someone playing a bagpipe, and made him lift up his jersey. He found he had a series of tubes leading to a bulb of urine in his armpit.
It's the with nail and eye approach to cheating.
So good. He was only given a 2-month suspension, which goes to show how, you know, rife cheating in the 70s and was in that. I also read about Boris Onyshenko. Oh, this is great. I mean, this is full-blown cheating. There's no odds about it, but it's such a great effort to try and win. He won a medal at the 1972 Olympics in modern pentathlon, came back in 1976.
This is the fencer.
Yes. Yeah.
I knew that name.
Second event in the modern pentathlon was the fencing. USSR were fourth overall after whatever the first event had been. And they go into these sort of one-touch epee bouts where they all sort of fight each other in the fencing. And he fought Britain's Jim Fox, and Britain complained that Onyshenko was scoring without hitting him. And what he'd done
was... Surely he should have answered was like, I'm just that quick, guys.
They seized his weapon. He did go on to, you know, win regardless, but the original weapon he'd been using, they discovered he'd hidden like a trigger inside the handle of it, which would close the circuit on the tip of it and register points for him even when he wasn't hitting you. And so the team were scratched, and then Onyshenko was ejected, and Britain went on to win the gold. 2 months later, papers reported that Onyshenko had been brought in to be scolded by Leonid Brezhnev himself. The newspapers in Britain called him Dishonyshenko, which is pretty good punning. A couple more horse ones before I come to my actual suggestion. 1908, the August bank holiday, big race weekend. There was a race meeting at Trodmore in Cornwall. And the Sportsman newspaper, there were two big sport newspapers, there was the Sporting Life and the Sportsman, and someone contacted the Sportsman saying, oh, we've got a race meet tomorrow, and the Sportsman said, oh, we can't send someone to cover it, will you please send us the results so we can print them? And Mr. G. Martin, who was the man on the phone, agreed to do that. And particularly, there was a lot of interest in a horse in the fourth race, a horse called Reaper, who won at 5-1. Great. A lot of the London bookies the next day, the results are published in the Sportsman, and the people were coming in asking him to pay out on the 5-1. And some of them were like, it hasn't been published in the Sporting Life, so we won't pay out just yet. So then Mr. Martin rang the Sporting Life to inform of the results, and they published the results the next day. But there was a printing error. It said he was at 5-2 rather than 5-1, so the bookies rang Trodmore Racecourse to check what the results had been. Only there was no Trodmore Racecourse. There isn't actually a place called Trodmore in Cornwall, and this was a scam, and the people who got away with it, because they were not caught, won about £100,000 off the bookies for this bet on Reaper. Inventing a race meet, and then a horse race, and a horse who they then said had won, and they
just go all in. Just make it all up, the race course, the horse.
It's so good.
Because there's definitely... there's something in that old adage, isn't there? The bigger the lie, the more people believe it.
Yeah.
You know, if you just throw all your chips at it, go on, let's just see.
That's quite an ingenious one. Couldn't get away with it now because there's phones and cameras and all sorts of ways.
Exercising psychology the whole time when you look at, you know, what these people intended to gain by it and how they intended to dupe people.
I have to say, my favourite part of that plan is I'm imagining the meeting where they invented the name of the place. Okay, we've got to come up with a name that's a believable place in Cornwall. Trodmore? Yeah, that's the winner.
Yeah, it's a moor. It's got a moor on it.
Yeah, and Trod is the right sort of first syllable in front of it. Another horse race, this is even better. In 1984, the Commerce Novice Second Division Handicap, a race run over 1,500 metres, took place at Eagle Farm in Brisbane, and was apparently won by a horse called Fine Cotton. Except... it was a bit of a surprise because Fine Cotton's previous race, he'd come 10th out of 12 horses and at odds of 20-1, and he'd come into this race at odds of 33-1. But there was a bit of a run on bets in favour of Fine Cotton. He eventually tightened up to 7-2 by the time the race went off, so it was a huge plunge, which obviously drew some attention to it. Apparently $1.5 million might have been won by one particular lucky group of backers, one syndicate led by a chap called John Gillespie, a former Bloodstock agent. What they had done was they had bought a lookalike horse, which got injured and was not able to run.
Uh-huh.
So they then had to buy another horse, again, a few divisions above Fine Cotton. But except this one was so last minute, they didn't buy a horse that quite looked the same as him. Yeah, Fine Cotton was a brown gelding, and this new horse, Bold Personality, was a bay, and he didn't have the markings, white markings on his hind legs. They dyed Bold Personality's hair colour using Clairol to make him the right colour, and on race day realised they'd forgotten to peroxide his hind legs.
Oh, this is sensational.
They just used white paint to paint his legs.
White paint on the legs.
By the time he crossed the line, the paint was already beginning to melt off his legs.
This'll do.
Yeah. So immediately people spotted that and called it out immediately. It's so, so good. By the time the stewards suspended the payouts and asked for the trainer to present him with his registration papers, the trainer had fled the course.
Of course he had.
Yeah.
Of course he had.
That's brilliant. Could he not have just gone like, oh, it's just go faster stripes on the horse. Yeah. That's all it is.
One little aside before I give you my actual choice. Do you remember what the really great act of sportsmanship when Robbie Fowler said he hadn't been fouled by David Seaman?
Oh, Highbury.
Yeah, yeah, in 1997. Yep. So he was getting Robbie Fowler with the ball. David Seaman, the goalkeeper, comes out, seemingly takes him down. The referee gives a penalty. Fowler protests. No. He didn't actually touch me. But the referee says, I've given the penalty. I can't reverse the decision. You must take the penalty. And Robbie Fowler very generously rolled quite a soft shot at David Seaman, which Seaman saved.
Mm-hmm.
And Jason McAteer ran in and smashed in the rebound.
Right. Yes, mate.
Yeah. What a dick.
So that reminds me of a thing. I can't remember where it is, but it was a match somewhere in South America or Central America where a goalkeeper collapsed because of heat exhaustion.
Yeah.
And again, the convention is just to roll the ball out of play. And the striker sees the goalkeeper collapse and goes, open goal, brilliant, knocks it in.
I think even worse, the defenders had it at their feet and were sort of like not sure what to do. And the striker dispossessed the defender.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
It's even worse. Yeah, oh God, footballers. I'm not going to football for my choice, so I'm going to baseball. Rather like you, Ben. And I'm going to suggest Albert Bell and the Cleveland Indians team from 1994. They were playing the Chicago White Sox in a game in America. And the White Sox manager, Gene Lambert, accused Bell of using a corked bat. So apparently what you do is you drill a little hole in a bat and you shove a tiny bit of cork inside it. Or sometimes they use like rubber.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically has the effect that if it makes contact with the baseball, it springboards
away.
Springboards it. There was a famous batsman called Sammy Sosa who was exposed for doing this because his bat exploded on contact with one ball and it revealed the cork inside.
Wow.
And so the umpires had no way to really know if this bat was corked unless they smashed it open. Obviously, they didn't want to smash the player's bat. So they said, let's swap it out, take another player's bat, we'll lock it in the office and we'll examine it at the end of the game. So the Indians manager, Mike Hargrove, called over his pitcher, Jason Grimsley, and said, that bat is corked, so you're going to have to sneak into that office and get the baseball bat out. Sent him on a heist, which involved Grimsley crawling through the air conditioning vents of the stadium while the match is ongoing to try and retrieve the bat. Like Bruce Willis in Die Hard.
Right.
So he did. He crawled all the way through, brought in a bat owned by his teammate Paul Sorrento, replaced the other one, climbed back out through the team tiles, got back to the bullpen beside the pitch. Everything fine. Except then a janitor went in to clean the umpire's office, unlocked it, discovered quite a dirty floor, and, a broken ceiling tile. Drew it to the attention of the umpires, which then led everyone to examine what had gone on, interrogate them. The Indians said, no, nothing to do with us. But that wasn't a good enough defence when the replacement bat that they'd snuck into the office was shown to have his teammate's name written on it. They forgot that every player has their name engraved on their bat, and it had Paul Sorrento, not Albert Bell, written on it.
That is beautiful.
They kept denying it. They had to call the Chicago Police Department and the FBI. They took fingerprints until eventually they caved and they suspended Bell. So it's a level of cheating, but also bad sportsmanship, and also incompetence that I love.
It's the holy trinity.
Show, it ticked all
the boxes. Because always, again, when such scams are exposed, what do you do? Do you front up? Do you put your arms up? Fair cop. Or do you double down? You know, do you Donald Trump it out?
Yeah.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, well, that's
just gaslight it out. You know? No, I didn't. That never happened.
I'm afraid the name of this team has always been the Miami Gaslighters.
So our candidates this week for the world's worst sportsmanship are Ben's suggestion of the Miami Marlins baseball team and their musical antics, and the suggestion of Rosie Ruiz, the lady who didn't run the marathon she said she did, and my suggestion of Albert Bell and the Cleveland Indians with with baseball bat heist coming soon to a movie theatre near you. They're all really good. I like the Marlins are great because they've got that like how to get inside, like it's proper gamesmanship, get inside your head.
It's something I didn't talk about, but Barry Fry, the old Peterborough manager, was famous for this. If the away dressing room, they turn the heating either up in summer
definitely.
And down in winter, and they wouldn't have painted it, and the showers wouldn't work.
That's absolutely bang on. Do you remember John Beck, manager of
Cambridge United.
A little bit earlier? I think he was an early adopter of such tactics as well.
Yeah.
Cold showers for the home side and unscrewing the pegs. You know, the dressing
that's
room
so petty.
For the, away team. It's so petty.
Yeah,
it's
but
so
the Miami Marlins, it's that to the next level.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Rosie Ruiz is a classic. Like one of the, I love, there's loads of stories. There's actually a whole Wikipedia page on people shortcutting marathons. Like there's a, you go on Rosie Ruiz's page and it's like one of the see alsos.
Cool.
So it's and it's a noble tradition dating back at least to the 1904 Olympics.
Seemed to, I don't know. Obviously the level of planning, because she, you know, cheated to get into the New York Marathon, yeah, and cheated away onto the Boston Marathon roster, and then to not fine tune it in any way, to just during the race, yeah, around the final curve, and not sweat. And
a friend of hers said in later life she admitted to it, but she also thought that she wouldn't come first. She had assumed that the first runners had already passed by.
Just a fundamental lack of planning.
Yeah. And I love Albert Bell because it's such a dumb story.
Yeah, that is dumb.
Ooh, I don't know who I'm gonna pick. Ben, help me out.
I mean, the common denominator is baseball.
It is. That's true.
But so, okay, let's think what they are. So it's either someone doing like, so Andy's one is a someone doing a really obvious one with very little planning, and it's done very badly, and she gets found out very easily. Mine is the one that really gets into their heads, yeah, and yours is just mistake after mistake after mistake.
I think we're going to go with that one, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah. It has to be. Okay, let's do that.
In which case, congratulations, Albert Bell and the Cleveland Indians. Before we go, I've got to give you some of the world's worst news of the week. This comes from the world of snooker. I thought it would be good to stay in the world of sports. The Shanghai Masters is taking place. Prize money's £750,000, yeah, yeah, one of the more prestigious events. And former world snooker champion Sean Murphy was leading 5-0 in his first round match, and then his opponent won a game, and Murphy was then won 6-1, but was suffering from an injury, which happened when he was dancing around the living room on Sunday afternoon with his 3-year-old son Harry to the Disney's Greatest Hits album. As sporting injuries go, it's not exactly, you know, David Beckham's metatarsal.
Well, I'd have to shave falling on, yeah, is it Canizares' foot?
Yeah. So I think in terms of a sportsman getting injured in the least sporty way, I'm going to put forward Paul Hunter. For
Do we definitely know he was dancing round the lounge with his daughter?
Maybe it was on his own. He's just added a child in. He doesn't even have a kid. He's just invented a child. It's like Stephen Ireland inventing a granny to get out of playing for Ireland. Before we go, Andy, where can we...
Rather than inventing a granny, so you can play for Ireland.
Yes. Years ago.
Tony Cascarino,
looking at you. Andy, before we go, where can people find out more about you and your work? Where might they be able to hear you anytime soon?
On a distant world feed channel near you. I do bits and pieces on Eurosport news on there, the odd magazine show, yeah. Various events and whatnot. World feed's strange because it's kind of heard by everyone and no one.
Yeah, sort of thing. Exactly.
Potential audience is in the gazillions, but you just never know who watches it and where it gets shown.
Yeah, it's like the World Service, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is a bit. Yeah.
That's it from us. We're all off to paint Ben and enter him at Ascot. Not in the way you think. Thank you for listening to Worst Before. Goodbye.